Ever notice those big highway projects popping up? You
Oh.
know, new overpasses, wider lanes. It always seems like progress, right?
Yeah, for sure.
But we rarely stop to think about what it took to get there, like whose property was impacted, who maybe had to make sacrifices for that so-called progress.
Right, yeah.
So today we're taking a deep dive into a case that really gets at the heart of that tension.
Okay.
It's the story of Luby's Fuddruckers and a highway expansion project that went a little sideways. I'm joined by our legal expert to break it all down. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me. I'm excited to dig in.
Me too. So, to set the scene for our listeners, can you give us the quick rundown of what happened with this Loopies?
Sure. Basically, the government needed a chunk of their parking lot to widen the highway.
Okay, makes sense. Happens all the time.
Right. But here's the catch. It wasn't the whole restaurant, just a part of the lot,
Okay.
but it was enough to basically make the place non-operational.
Oh, wow. So, like, not enough parking for customers, I'm guessing.
Exactly. Imagine trying to run a busy cafeteria with almost nowhere for people to park.
Yeah, that's a death sentence for any restaurant. No parking, no customers.
Pretty much. And that's where this idea of eminent domain comes in.
Right. The government's power to take private property, even if the owner doesn't want to sell.
Yep, it's in the Fifth Amendment of the U.S. Constitution. They can take it for public use, but they got to pay you just compensation.
Just compensation. Easy to say, but not always easy to figure out, huh? Especially for a business like this.
That's the million-dollar question, literally. And in this case, Luby's really fought for what they consider just.
So walk us through that. What were they asking for?
Well, the obvious part was compensation for the land itself, the market value of what the government took.
Right. But it sounds like they were after more than that.
Oh, yeah. They also wanted compensation for lost profits, you know, the money they would have made while they were forced to rebuild or find a new location.
I can see why they'd want that. If you can't operate, you're losing potential income every day.
Exactly. And that's where things get legally interesting because the court ultimately said no to the lost profits. We'll get into the why of that. It's kind of juicy.
Okay, definitely want to unpack that. But before we get too deep, I think it's important to back up a bit.
Sure.
Can you remind our listeners, like, the real basics of eminent domain? I know we throw around these terms, but maybe not everyone's a legal eagle like you.
Absolutely. So, as I mentioned, it's in the Fifth Amendment, this takings clause. What it boils down to is this: the government, whether it's federal, state, or local, they have this power to take private property.
Right.
But it's not a free-for-all. They can't just snatch up your land because they feel like it.
Yeah, there's got to be a reason.
Right. It has to be for what's considered public use. So things like building roads, schools, hospitals, public utilities, stuff that benefits everyone.
Okay, so there's a public purpose behind it, but even then, they still have to pay you, right?
Exactly. That's the crucial part. The Fifth Amendment says they have to provide just compensation to the property owner.
And Texas, where this Luby's was, it has a similar provision in its own constitution, right?
Yep, pretty much every state does. So you've got this inherent tension built right into the system.
I see it. On one hand, you have the government's power to take what it needs, supposedly for the greater good, but then you also have the individual's right to own property and to not just be pushed around by the government, even if it's for a good cause.
That's exactly it. It's one of those classic legal balancing acts.
So let's get back to Luby's and their particular situation. Can you remind us specifically what went down with their property?
So the state of Texas, they're expanding a highway, right? And they need a piece of Luby's parking lot for it.
Okay.
The restaurant building itself, untouched.
All right.
But they take a big enough slice of the parking lot that it essentially shuts the restaurant down.
And that's where their argument for just compensation gets interesting, right?
For sure. They weren't just arguing about the value of the land they lost. It was about the business they lost, too.
Because technically, they could still operate the restaurant, just probably not very successfully with zero parking.
Exactly. It's not like they took the whole building and forced them to move,
Right.
but they made it impossible to realistically run the business there. So that's why Luby's was saying, hey, we deserve compensation for the land and for the lost profits while we're in limbo.
That's a good argument. And what did the state say to that?
Well, they brought in their own valuation expert, a guy named Mike Welch.
Okay.
And he actually did something interesting. He used like a hybrid approach to value the property.
What do you mean by that?
Well, typically you'd use one of three main methods:
Mm-hmm.
sales comparison, seeing what similar property sold for,
Right.
income capitalization, looking at how much money the property could generate as a business.
Uh-huh.
And then there's the cost approach, which is basically what would it cost to rebuild the improvements on the land?
Okay, I follow. So which one did the state's expert use?
He kind of combined them, took like a weighted average of all three.
Oh, interesting. So he was factoring in what that property could earn as a restaurant.
Exactly. And that becomes a super important point later on in the case.
Okay, I'm intrigued. What about Luby's? Did they use the same approach?
Not exactly. They had their own expert, Mark Sykes. He leaned more heavily on the cost approach, but he also added this whole other layer to it. He said they needed to consider the kitchen equipment as fixtures.
Fixtures, meaning like permanently attached to the building, not just movable appliances, right?
Exactly. Think ovens, walk-in coolers, that kind of stuff. He was saying this equipment is so specialized and fitted to this space, it's basically part of the real estate.
I see. So by classifying it as fixtures, it bumps up the overall property value because you're not just talking about empty space anymore.
Bingo. You got it. So we have these two competing valuations going on.
And I'm guessing that sets the stage for a good old-fashioned legal battle.
Oh, yeah. It went to trial, and the jury actually sided with Luby's, at least initially.
No way. They really awarded them both the property value and the lost profits.
They did. $1.3 million for the property and another $480,000 for lost profits. So it looked like a pretty big win for Luby's.
I bet the state wasn't too happy about that.
Nope, not one bit. They took it straight to the appeals court.
And what was their main beef on appeal?
Double recovery. They were basically saying, hey, you can't have your cake and eat it too.
Interesting. Break that down for me. What exactly were they arguing?
Their argument was that the market value awarded by the jury that already included the potential profits from the restaurant.
Because of how the state's own expert had valued it, right?
Precisely. Remember, he used that weighted average, factoring in things like income potential. So the state was saying, look, you've already been compensated for the fact that this was a money-making property. Now you're trying to get paid extra for the profits you would have made.
Okay, I see their point. It's like you can't get compensated twice for the same thing.
Exactly. It's this legal principle called the double recovery doctrine.
So how does that usually play out in eminent domain cases? Are lost profits always off the table?
It's a bit tricky. There are some exceptions, but generally, lost profits aren't automatically part of just compensation.
Really? Why is that?
Well, the thinking is that market value should, in theory, already capture the earning potential of a property.
Oh, so it's built into the price, so to speak.
Right. But there are a couple of key exceptions.
Okay, lay them on me.
One big one is what's called material interference with access.
Material interference. Sounds serious.
It is. Basically, it means the government's action has made it physically impossible for you to use your property.
Like you literally can't get to it, customers can't reach you, that kind of thing.
Yep. Think a road closure that completely blocks off your storefront.
So did that apply to Luby's?
The court said no. Even though they lost a chunk of parking, it wasn't a total blockage of access.
Yeah, that's a tough one. I can see both sides of it. They weren't completely blocked off, but they might as well have been for all practical purposes.
Right, it's a gray area for sure. And there's another exception where lost profits might come into play.
Okay, tell me more.
It's when those lost profits help show how much the remaining property has been devalued.
Devalued, meaning like it's worth less now because of the taking.
Exactly. Like, let's say they took a chunk of land that made the rest unusable or significantly less valuable.
Okay.
In those cases, you might be able to point to lost profits to prove that the remaining land is worth way less now.
Interesting. So it's not about getting compensated for the lost profits themselves, but about showing how they impact the value of what's left.
Precisely. But in this case, Luby's wasn't really making that argument. They were focused on those lost profits as a separate category of damages.
Got it. So the court had to figure out whether these lost profits were justified on top of the market value they'd already received.
Right. And that's where this important legal precedent comes in. It's called the Whataburger test.
Whataburger, as in the Texas fast food chaining.
The very same. Apparently, they had their own eminent domain battle a while back.
Huh. You learn something new every day. So what's this Whataburger test all about?
It basically lays down the law on this whole double recovery issue with lost profits.
Okay.
It says that if the method used to value the property already considers its profit-making ability, then awarding separate lost profits is a no-go.
So if they already factored in what the business could earn, you can't get extra for the earnings you missed out on.
Exactly. And that's what sunk Luby's.
How so?
Remember how the state's expert used that weighted average method that included the income approach?
Yeah.
Well, the court said that meant the jury's award for market value already accounted for the restaurant's profitability.
Ah, so they were essentially trying to get paid twice for the same burger.
That's a great way to put it. The court even said, and I'm quoting here, that profitability of the restaurant was a factor in arriving at the market value, so it cannot also recover for lost profits.
That pretty much sums it up. You can't get separate compensation for something that's already baked into the price.
Right. And they actually made a pretty good analogy in the ruling.
I'm all ears.
They said it's like someone buying you a burger, then also giving you money because you couldn't eat it for a while.
Haha, I love that. Makes it so much clearer.
Right. Like, you've already been compensated for the burger, whether you eat it right away or not.
Okay, that settles the lost profits issue. But what about the other thing Luby's was fighting for?
Ah, yes. The kitchen equipment and whether it should be considered fixtures.
Remind us why that was such a big deal for them.
Well, if it's just movable equipment, it's personal property.
Right.
But if it's a fixture, it becomes part of the real estate.
And therefore, part of what the government has to pay for.
Exactly. So Luby's was arguing that their ovens, refrigerators, all that specialized stuff, it was so integral to the restaurant, it should be treated as fixtures.
Which would obviously increase the overall compensation they'd get.
Right. It's not just about the land anymore. It's about the value of the whole setup.
Makes sense. So what happened with that argument? Did the court buy it?
Well, it's a bit nuanced. Luby's really wanted the judge to give the jury specific instructions about how to consider the equipment.
Like, walk them through that three-part test you mentioned earlier, the annexation, adaptation, and intent thing.
Yep, exactly that. They wanted the judge to say, hey, jury, look at this equipment through the lens of fixtures. Consider if it meets the criteria.
Seems like a reasonable request. Why wouldn't the judge do that?
It comes down to this tricky balance judges have to strike when instructing a jury.
How so?
They have to give the jury the right legal framework.
Uh-huh.
But they also can't be seen as swaying the jury's decision or putting too much emphasis on one piece of evidence over another.
Ah, okay. So it's about being neutral, letting the jury weigh the evidence themselves.
Exactly. And in this case, the judge felt that giving specific instructions about the kitchen equipment would be overstepping that boundary.
So what did they do instead?
They gave a general instruction on market value.
Meaning, like, figure out what this property is worth as a whole, using your best judgment.
Pretty much. And that included letting the jury decide whether the equipment was permanently attached, adapted to the building, intended to stay, all that jazz.
Okay, so they left it up to the jury to apply those principles to the equipment without explicitly telling them to focus on it as fixtures.
Right. Luby's wanted to nudge them in a certain direction, but the court said, nope, let them figure it out.
Interesting. So even though Luby's didn't get those specific instructions, the jury still could have considered the equipment as part of the property's value, right?
Absolutely. It was still on the table. The judge just didn't want to single it out and potentially influence their thinking.
Okay, I get it. So big picture, what are some of the key takeaways from this whole Luby's saga for our listeners out there, especially those who are studying law?
I think the biggest thing is understanding this link between how you value a property in eminent domain and what kind of compensation you can get.
Right. It's not just about the raw land value, especially when you're talking about a business.
Exactly. And this case highlights how tricky it could be to separate the value of the property itself from the business that operates on it.
Yeah, they're kind of intertwined.
They are. And this whole idea of double recovery is crucial. Like, you can't get paid twice for the same economic loss.
And lost profits, they're not always out of the question, but you have to be really careful about how you argue for them.
For sure. If the property's value already reflects those profits, you're probably out of luck.
And it's fascinating to see how much power the trial judges have in shaping how a jury considers evidence.
Oh yeah, that's a huge point. It's not just about presenting the facts, it's about how those facts are framed for the jury.
And those jury instructions, they can make a big difference in the outcome of a case.
Absolutely. So for aspiring lawyers out there, pay attention to those jury instructions. They're not just legal formalities.
So to wrap up our deep dive into the State v. Luby's Fuddruckers case, I think we've seen a great example of how courts try to balance competing interests.
Yeah, they're trying to be fair to property owners, but also make sure the government isn't just handing out blank checks.
And when it comes to businesses, just compensation is rarely simple. It's not just about the land, it's about the livelihood that's attached to it.
Right. And the legal system has to find ways to account for that while also preventing people from getting more than they're due.
It's a delicate balance for sure, but it makes you think, are there situations where maybe just focusing on market value isn't enough?
It's a good question. Like, what about those intangible losses? Things like reputation, customer relationships, the disruption of having to relocate your whole business.
Those things are hard to put a price tag on.
They are. And the law is always evolving to address these kinds of challenges.
So if this deep dive into the Luby's Fuddruckers case got you thinking, I'd encourage you to explore other eminent domain cases too.
Yeah, see how these principles play out in different scenarios. Maybe check out that Whataburger case we mentioned.
There's a whole world of legal battles out there just waiting to be unpacked.
That's for sure.
All right, that's a wrap for today. Until next time, keep digging deeper.
Always.
Thanks for listening to The Deep Dive.